Thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and if you're just tuning into this program, we're listening to the really big challenges of the 21st century. Where are the breakthroughs in the 21st century? What can be done with energy, water, cancer, and climate change?
David Keith joins us, professor of applied physics at Harvard School of Engineering and Applied Science. 2009 Time Magazine listed him as one of the heroes, its heroes of the environment. He's been working on big energy and environment challenges like carbon sequestration and geoengineering. David Keith, thank you very much for joining us. joining us today.
Hi, Tom. Great to be back on your show.
And Jeffrey Grossman joins us, professor of material science and engineering at MIT. He's been researching ways to desalinate salt water to help solve the world's growing shortage of fresh water. Talk about a big challenge for this century. Jeffrey Grossman, welcome. Wonderful to have you here.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
David Keith, first of all, just to the big question, do we need to be having this conversation? Is there a big overarching problem, or are you all about the nuts and bolts of your particular technological challenge, ambition?
Yeah, we do need to have it. And it's really good to bring up this kind of analogy between Apollo and the climate energy challenges we face. And I have contradictory views. On the one hand, as an environmentalist, I'm conscious of all the environmental consequences of kind of technological overreach of the post-war era,
yeah.
Ozone hole, smog, et cetera. But I also am very conscious of the fact that we now live in a world where people are perhaps have overreacted in the opposite direction and are so skeptical about technology that they fail to realize that many of the ways we address those problems were fundamentally technological. So if you think about the way we've solved the ozone problem or the way we've made air pollution substantially better than it was, the way we've done that have all been through technological fixes, of course, fundamentally driven by policy, driven by clear-eyed policy. But the idea that many people seem to have that we solve these things just by kind of reduced green consumption, I think really misunderstands the way that technology has both been the source of these problems, but also the way you solve them.
So we need to get it right. We need to use it in the right way, and that is not easy to sort out. But we also need to do it. I mean, Jeffrey Grossman, I'm looking here at a headline from this week saying that the Colorado River, which now brings fresh water to so much of the western United States, will not meet the needs of Americans in seven states. This is a 50-year-out report. So your work on desalinization of seawater could be absolutely critical right here in this country, never mind the world. Do you see the country set up in such a way as to support your research and take it through to a big, gnarly solution here, Jeffrey?
Well, I think that's a great question, and I think that we're not quite there yet. I mean, to follow up on your point, you know, the United Nations predicts that 2/3 of the world population will be living in a water-scarce place by 2025, and that's not just people in developing countries. It's also many people right here in the United States.
Sure.
So this is a really big problem, and what's needed here, so here's the rub, is that it's not going to be solved with the current technology. So what we need are new ideas, and we need new ideas that lead to new technologies, and that can only come from a long-term investment in basic research and innovation. And that's why the government role in this is so important, because the VCs and the existing industry isn't willing to take that kind of risk.
Let's look at yours. I mean, reverse osmosis, we've all heard about, but it's very, and that can turn salt water into fresh water, but it's very energy intensive, which doesn't sound good for this century. It's slow. You've got another way at it. As we're set up now, as a country, do you feel the resources, the push at your back to step forward on this potentially big critical solution, Jeffrey, just when it comes to delivering fresh water, just that single thing?
I don't think that it's there yet, because I think that, you know, again, I think what we need is investment in more basic research to create new ideas, to create new learning curves. Mm-hmm. So if you take, for example, what's happening in solar energy, you have, you know, this tremendous growth, 75% increase in capacity last year, but that's because of cheaper manufacturing subsidized by regulation and a cheap labor market, which has now all moved to China.
Mm-hmm.
So this growth seems good, and it's made installers happy, but because of it, innovation has been completely deprived, and it's led to the unsustainability of U.S. and European manufacturers. So the problem is that cheaper versions of existing technologies in solar cells or water are not going to solve the problem, because it's not going to be good enough to make the impact that's needed to meet the challenge. What we need are game-changing ideas which come from deeper understanding and basic research. So the competition shouldn't be driven now by a race to the bottom. It should be driven by innovation, since we don't have the right technology to start with. And that's where large-scale programs that invest in basic research and understanding are critical at this stage.
We need the breakthroughs, not just cheaper and cheaper manufacturing, but breakthroughs to make it possible. David Keith, do you feel the support? I mean, here you're looking at carbon sequestration. I mean, that's one thing coming out of a power plant is another thing coming out of the tailpipe of a car. And we already know that climate change seems to be galloping ahead. So the other piece of your work, geoengineering, actually, you know, sort of getting engaged at the planetary level in helping buffer some of the effects of that, maybe will be required. Do you feel the policies at your back to bring these breakthroughs to fruition, David?
No, I mean, we have essentially a deep social failure on climate policy, where we have many people in the country who simply don't believe we have a problem and a kind of fundamental failure to engage in the problem in a serious way. And I think to bring back to the earlier conversation about what was so unique about the era, say, of the Apollo era, where there were these very strong, centrally driven kind of policy focus. We're not in that era anymore. And if you think about NASA now compared to then, unbelievably bureaucratic, unbelievably risk-averse. So on the one hand, we need to be able to find ways to really focus our energy.
Which means the government itself is not necessarily the answer here. It too can become ossified.
It has become ossified, but on the other hand, for social problems like this, government's role is central. They shouldn't drive the exact technological choice, but they have to provide the signal. And there are other problems. Actually, water's a problem where innovation is great and certainly important, but that's one where pricing and markets are really the centerpiece. You can easily make a strong argument. We don't have serious water constraints except for really terrible policies about how we allocate and price water.
One way or another, we can't afford not to address these issues, though. David Keith, I know we have to let you go. Jeffrey Grossman, I hope you'll stick with us. David Keith is professor of applied physics at Harvard School of Engineering and Applied Science, doing big work on carbon sequestration, on geoengineering, planetary scale, and we may need it. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
We're talking this hour about accomplishing big, big things again, scientific, technological breakthroughs 40 years after man last stood on the moon. Why that hasn't been happening so much and what it would take to do it now in the 21st century when the need is pressing. Jason Ponton is with us, editor-in-chief of MIT's Technology Review. They've got a big, big issue on this, why we can't solve big problems. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Jeffrey Grossman at MIT is with us as well. He's working on one of those very big problems. That is getting enough fresh water, maybe changing salt water to fresh water. We may need that in this century. Mike in Dothan, Alabama. Mike, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking it. My children had full rides to MIT coming from a little town in Alabama.
Good for you.
And how did you do that? I motivated them. Where is the motivation that I got, and I was born in the 60s, from the president, from the public media, to encourage these children, young people, or anybody, to solve what problems you're talking about? In order to, we've got to get mom and pop America pushing them or encouraging them.
Yes.
And the only way we're going to do it is coming from a society that says, hey, this is what we need to look at. The young man who developed what we call turkey feathers for the Apollo program, they made a movie about him. He became a director of NASA. Main thing is he was motivated by parents. How does America get back into motivating them, get away from apps, all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, right there, from the home ground up. Mike, I appreciate your call. Jason Ponton, you're thinking about this a lot. What about just the ambition? I mean, one worry is it's possible to lose the sense that these things can be done, and the ambition then goes with it because you just sort of lose the sense it's possible.
Well, Kennedy heroized the difficult and the dangerous and the grand, didn't he? And there's no one doing that at the moment. All three of your callers, and both Jeffrey and David, have pointed to one of the reasons we think that we can't solve big problems, which is the failure in our political institutions. And our incapacity to create clean energy is a really good example here, Tom. Less than 2% of global energy consumption comes from advanced renewable sources like solar and wind.
Even now, when we know the cost of using old, dirty energy.
And the reason is almost wholly cost. Coal and natural gas are simply cheaper than solar and wind, and petroleum is cheaper than biofuels. We need what David called breakthroughs, what Bill Gates, the founder of Microsoft, sometimes calls miracle technologies.
But we've been in the era of markets first, and the markets don't solve this because, as you say, fossil fuels are wonderfully cheap by comparison.
And the paradox, the irony, is that there is, in fact, broad consensus amongst technologists and economists about what the policies would be that would create clean energy. They're very simple, and yet we can't do it. We would have to increase our R&D spending. Bill Gates has said there should be a threefold increase. At the moment, we only spend $5 billion a year on clean energy research. To give you some context, we spend $40 billion a year just on the National Institutes of Health alone. We need to put a price on carbon, either a direct tax or some more opaque
market mechanism. To level the cost playing field a bit for users. But people say, come on, you're just making my life more expensive. I can't bear it. I'm already, struggling.
Well, for that, we're either going to pay now, one or two 2% more in energy costs, or we're going to have huge economic problems, not just 50 years ahead of us, but in 10 years. We need some kind of energy regulatory structure. It's how we reduce pollutions in cities. The energy industry itself has said they want a clear signal from the government about what the cap on emissions would be. And then finally, we need shared pilot plants in which we could test out and scale new ideas. Everyone knows these are the policy solutions, and yet we don't have it because one of the political parties in this country is irredeemably and irreducibly opposed to any regulation and affects to believe that climate change is not even a problem.
Affects as in pretends. You don't think they mean it?
It's very difficult, based upon the science that we now have, to believe that educated people sincerely don't believe in climate change.
And yet, why are we not being driven by necessity right past those, if they're postures, right past those postures in this generation? Joe in Marfa, Texas. Joe, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I want to tell you that the single purpose for every technological advance since World War II has been for military reasons. We ran to get the German scientists because of their missile technology. Eisenhower had to convince the United States and the people that they'd have a better life because he knew we had to build a military highway system that equaled the Autobahn during World War II.
To move troops around, maybe, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. JFK sold us on the fact to go into the moon with all of this highfalutin talking because we were afraid that the Russians would get to the moon and their military ability to send us missiles. Then we got involved, both Eisenhower and JFK, in the Vietnam War in order to defeat Russia and the military. Okay, Clinton came on board, and he was able to reduce the defense spending. But after that, Reagan had to increase the defense spending to such a point where we could put Russia out of business. All right, then the next couple of wars. All right, drone technology has taken all the money. See,
well, I don't know about all the money, but you're quite, I mean, it's undeniable that the Cold War was huge here, military. Joe, let me pick it up right there with our guest, if I may. Jeffrey Grossman, what about it? Can we, you know, we look back and maybe it's too easy to say, wow, they were ambitious in this sort of touchy-feely way. Does it require a military threat, a Cold War, for us to get our act together and meet challenges of this scale, Jeffrey?
Well, I think it definitely, I certainly hope it doesn't. I think that moonshots can be so important because they exemplify these sort of bold visions and concrete goal setting that we need, as well as just a belief in human inventiveness that I think is kind of lacking often today. But I want to make a point that, you know, a moonshot initiative not only engages the general public in understanding how important these problems is and what the role of science and technology is in solving them, but it also galvanizes the scientists and engineers themselves. And, you know, scientists and engineers are at their best when they care most about getting things done and least about, you know, say, who gets the credit. And when they work on, you know, in teams that come together around the common excitement to solve a really hard problem and not around the common need to just get the funding. So what a moonshot program does is it provides the absolute best kind of environment for this type of problem-driven science, you know, to thrive.
Yep.
I think that's another really important reason for pushing and promoting these kinds of initiatives.
I mean, Jason, so there was the Cold War. There were military threats. And what are those threats? I mean, those would reduce the quality of your life. But yet we're facing other threats that would reduce the quality of our lives. What's the galvanizing, what could be, should be, the galvanizing factor today?
Well, we don't lack for challenges, Tom. 1 billion people in the world want electricity. Millions are without clean water. The climate's changing. Our manufacturing base is collapsing. Traffic snarls cities. Education is a luxury.
With all that, I mean, here's Gary writes online. He says, big challenges, more like epic challenges. He says, well beyond just needing moxie, it's going to take global Herculean effort. It would feel great if we were in the midst of that effort, rather than feeling like we're kind of a little bit becalmed as these things mount. What galvanizes that?
I think we need a sense of urgency, and that will have to come from our political leaders, from academia, and finally from the public itself. It's not true that we can't solve big problems through technology. We can, and we must.
Okay, we need urgency. I mean, if it's not going to come out of, you know, somebody saying, there are communists at the door, where does it come from? There's certainly people out there who feel urgency. We hear them on this show. We bring them on. They talk about the climate. The urgency is pins the needle. But, you know,
well, sometimes people say that for there to be a sense of urgency about climate change, we'd have to lose a city, but perhaps we have in New Orleans.
Or New York just got hit. I mean, we didn't lose it, but we've seen the threat.
I think one of the reasons, and I know Jeff would agree, about why the moonshot was so successful is that it had a distinct end. There was a thing to do. Mm-hmm. We only had to galvanize ourselves for a decade, and at the end we could plant the stars and stripes and the sea of tranquility and say we've done that. The problem about some of the challenges I've been discussing is that they have no clear end. They go on and on and on. So they need to be framed in a way that the public knows what they're committing to when they accept that their tax dollars will go to serve it.
Well, let's look at that. Jeffrey Grossman, in your field, water. I mean, presumably you have some sense of when we are going to actually need breakthroughs or else be thirsty. That's pretty compelling.
Yeah, my sense is that we needed it to be in place 10 or 20 years ago, and there is a real sense of urgency. I mean, and you know, we have to keep in mind, we throw around these percentages, 1% of water on Earth is usable fresh water, but we have to keep in mind that the total amount of water is also fixed. There's no more being created, even though the population and industrial needs are growing. And so this is a really urgent problem. And if you do a search right now on the federal grants that are available for research on water, you get zero results. So there's currently no funding really in place that exists for basic research in next-generation water desalination technologies. And yet this is such an urgent problem. And I think it's exactly what Jason has said. It's that, you know, the Apollo – this is hard to frame. The Apollo project took 7 years, Tom, as you said in the beginning of the show. The Manhattan project took 4. These are great examples of national-level coordination and our ability to think and dream and act big. But the kinds of projects we need now – aren't yet ready for that type of finite time frame. What we need now is big investment in creating the knowledge that will lead to the innovation. We need new learning curves, and this is going to be creating the new ideas that can lead to the new technologies. And I know that's hard because we live in a world of instant gratification, and taking the long-term view can be a hard sell. But, you know, for the Apollo mission, we had the technology we needed already invented. For the challenges we face in energy and clean water, those technologies still need to be invented. They don't exist yet.
I mean, I hear what you're saying. And yet, you know, 4 years for the Manhattan Project, 4 years is not that long. 4 years ago, we had the same problems we have now. 7 years for the moonshot, even 7 years is not that long. If we could frame these things upright and do something in a time frame like that, it'd sure be great. Jason, you quote Saul Bellow, thinking back to the attitude of a different time, 1970 in Mr. Samler's Planet, the sense of urgency that was beyond military, it was almost kind of cosmic. He said, you know, we need to blow this great blue, white, green planet, as in get out of here, move on out into the solar system, the galaxy, or to be blown from it. 1970, here we are, 2012. Why don't we feel that urgency and act on it right now?
Professor Zinn, as you know, after the invasion of Iraq, polls showed that up to 60% of the American people fully believed that Saddam Hussein was involved in 9/11 and believed that he was closely associated with Al-Qaeda. Even after President Bush, when he was finally put in a corner, admitted there was no connection, polls showed that still 30% of American people believe that. Now, American people aren't stupid. My opinion, and this is a question to you, is the American corporate media at fault here?
Well, there's no question that you're right. No, I agree with you. The American people are not stupid, but they can be misinformed. And they have been misinformed consistently by the corporate media. Fox Television, CNN, the major newspapers, the major television stations, the Washington Post, which is a major newspaper, which is supposed to be liberal, admitted some time ago that it had given the American people false information about weapons of mass destruction, that it had gone along and simply conveyed the administration's misinformation about that to the American public. So, no, I agree with you very much that the reason so much of the American public still believes facts which have turned out to be false is because they have had a very bad education by the media. They certainly have had a very bad education in the history of this country, and certainly a bad education about what is going on in the world. We need to look for alternative media. I applaud programs like this, which give us viewpoints that you will not get on NBC or CBS. I applaud Amy Goodman's Democracy Now! And David Bastamian's Alternative Radio and Pacifica, and all those attempts to bring information to the public which it does not get from the corporate media.
We have one last call. Camdenton, Missouri, you're on the air.
Hello, yes. So according to you, in the last 60 years or so, there's a vast conspiracy among all of our legislature, our government, that we're going to do everything wrong, and we're going to do everything we can to diminish the United States in everything we do. We don't have a government in Vietnam. We don't have a government in Germany, etc. We help these people. And George Bush, in the last 4 years, has not ruined education and health care and whatever. There is no vast conspiracy to ruin the United States. Are you a communist?
There are two questions there. The second one. No, I'm not communist. I remember the Communist Party and so on. I thought that was a question that left us a long time ago. I believe in a kind of socialism. I believe in democratic socialism. And I believe that resources of society should be more equally distributed among people. And everybody's entitled to certain basic things. And, you know, you can call that whatever you like, but, you know, I think that would be a good society. I believe in a peaceful world. I don't believe in war. The American people are not stupid, but they can be misinformed. And they have been misinformed consistently by the corporate media.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.